CliffCentral.com.
Flemming Rose is a Danish newspaper editor. He's been the cultural editor and the foreign affairs editor for Jyllands Posten. You will remember his name. If you remember his name, I'll be very impressed if you do. But if you know it, it's because of the context of those Muhammad cartoons all those years ago. He's become an advocate for free speech, and he is currently all over the world delivering speeches on this matter, on related matters, still very much involved in what is offensive and what's allowed, what's not allowed, how Islam and the West interact, secular societies and religious societies and so on. And it's my pleasure to have him here this morning to talk to us. And he's a guest in South Africa of the Institute of Race Relations. So, Flemming Rose, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. You're something of a hero to me, not because you're one of those people who courts controversy, but because of what you've had to say since the controversies developed all those years ago. And just to put it in context so that people who might not remember the story do, a very, very big deal was made of this little Danish newspaper. Look, in Denmark, it's quite substantial.
Yeah, it was a big newspaper in Denmark, but on a global scale, it's pretty small, yeah. By the way, I'm not working there anymore.
Yeah, that's correct.
I'm a senior faith fellow now at Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. And I'm hosting a TV program on Danish public broadcasting about the crisis of the West and about the crisis of Enlightenment values that I would like to stand up for.
Well, you are. But to remind people of what happened, that the situation that created your fame or infamy, depending on which side of the fence you're on, the Jyllands Posten newspaper published some cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Yes. You'd invited readers. There was something going on. People needed illustrations for a book about Muhammad.
A children's book.
About his life.
Usually you have illustrations of the main character in a children's book.
All children's books, as I recall growing up, are much better and sell better if you have pictures in them. And I remember seeing storybooks about the life of Jesus, and I thought, all right, well, that's kind of, pictures of him on the Sea of Galilee and all the rest of it. And you would expect that every historical figure would eventually end up being depicted in pictures, not necessarily cartoons, but in pictures, to be seen and admired by children and get them interested in the material. However, this created a whole controversy. So you said, fine, I'm cultural affairs editor. Let's take submissions from people who want to depict Muhammad as you see him. Clearly, this is a cultural issue. It's something that we must talk about. So send me your pictures of how you would see the Prophet Muhammad.
And it's important to stress here that it was an open invitation. It was not an invitation to mockery or ridicule, but because some of the people I invited, they are cartoonists, or most of them, some of the cartoons turned out to be satirical, but not all of them. And in fact, they did not all depict Muhammad, because they chose to approach the issue in very different ways. And one of the cartoons, in fact, made fun of me. And two other cartoons made fun of the children's writer who said publicly that he couldn't find an illustrator for this job, indicating that this was just a PR stunt on his behalf, which in fact it was. And it later turned out that several illustrators had turned down the offer, and the one who finally said yes insisted on anonymity, which is a way of self-censorship. You do not want to appear under your own name because you are afraid of the consequences. And he later acknowledged that he was in fact afraid, and he referred to the fate of the Indian-born British writer Salman Rushdie, who published the Satanic Verses.
Still lives under a fatwa, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And Theo van Gogh, a less-known Dutch filmmaker, who was killed on the streets of Amsterdam in 2004 because he made a documentary criticizing the justification of violence against women based in the Prophet's life and in the holy texts.
You probably thought, I'm living in a Western secular democracy. You assumed there will be a basic level of tolerance for difference of opinion. There is obviously, because it's a liberal democracy, there's going to be some blowback perhaps from the left in terms of let's not denigrate the cultural beliefs and sensitivities of minorities. But you could in no way have been prepared for the outpouring of hostility, violence, anger, and widespread nastiness that that ensued in the publication of these cartoons.
And anyone who today says, well, you should have known, they are just, you know, after the fact, rationalizing an absurd situation, I think. In fact, in the fall of 2005, after the publication of the cartoons, when we had a heated debate in Denmark, one of the leading experts on Islam in Denmark, who was very critical of the publication of the cartoons, said on radio that this is never going to be a big international issue because it's too small. 2 months later, the world was in uproar, and you had, you know, people demonstrating in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, boycotting Danish products.
Embassies were attacked.
Yes, burning in Beirut, in Damascus, in Tehran. A lot of people getting killed in Nigeria, where you already had a conflict between Christians and Muslims, and this issue was being exploited by some of the Muslims to go after Christians. Nobody could have foreseen. And it's a very interesting case study in the way the forces of globalization frames, you know, issues on a global scale. I mean, we have had publications of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad before, not in my newspaper, but other cartoonists did that around
even
the world.
Even in Islamic countries and in history, there was no problem with depicting the Prophet up to a certain point, and then a certain sect of Islam decided that it was not right to
especially
show.
Within Sunni Islam, it's now a taboo. But if you go to Tehran, you could buy posters with images of the Prophet. So many Sunni Muslims believe that this is founded in the texts, but it's not. There is nowhere in the Quran where it says that you are not allowed to depict the Prophet Muhammad. But nevertheless, this tradition has developed.
Can we just first talk about the actual cartoons? Because I think most of us know about Vestergaard's one with the turban with the bomb in it. There were others that were, I suppose, meant to be satirical, some of them that were probably trying to be offensive. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Of course not.
You know, if you're an adult, you should be able to decide that's not for me.
And what's the meaning of a cartoon?
Sure. But to resort to violence is a whole separate matter.
Absolutely.
Were you, when you looked at them, were you circumspect about what you kept in and what you threw out?
I put everything in. I mean, because, you know, there are 25 active members of the Danish Cartoonist Association, and I received 12 cartoons, which is about 50%. This was an exercise in dealing with self-censorship when it comes to the coverage of Islam in Denmark and Western Europe. So as an editor, I mean, if it's an exercise in self-censorship, you do not throw out things because you can be accused of then censoring yourself. We published all 12 cartoons that we received, and I wrote a short text laying out the reasoning behind the cartoons, why we decided to publish them, with a reference to the way humor is being criminalized in oppressive societies. I spent time in the Soviet Union myself. I studied, in fact, Soviet jokes. During the times of Stalin, you could go to jail for telling a joke for 10 years. So oppressive regimes have always had problems with jokes and with some forms of cartoons. But of course, I did not expect a reaction like the one we received a few months later. I expected a debate about the problems of self-censorship. You know, back then we had two questions, I would say. One was, is there self-censorship? Some people said, no, there is no self-censorship. Other people were saying, yes, there is self-censorship. So we wanted to find out if there is self-censorship or not. And the other question was, if there is self-censorship, is that self-censorship based in a fictional fear, or is it based in a real fear, or in reality? And today, you know, almost 12 years later, we can say, yes, there is self-censorship, and yes, the fear is based in reality, because my friends and colleagues in at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, they were in fact killed, and there was a very close attempt on Westergaard's life. He was very nearly killed.
You yourself were on an Al Qaeda hit list.
Yes, I still am, and that's why I live with 24/7 security in Europe. You know, at some point you have to make a decision. I mean, is it worth defending these principles? I could at some point have withdrawn from the public space. I did that for a while, but I just believe that these issues are very important to me. I spent time in an oppressive dictatorship in the Soviet Union. I had friends among dissidents who went to labor camps and who were exiled and lost their jobs for saying the things they believed in. And this is a very important part of my own identity and who I want to be. It's not that I'm crazy. I want to live as everybody else. But I just think that it's very important to stand up for this and be aware that there are people around the world and throughout history who in fact have paid with their lives for the kind of freedoms that we are enjoying today. I mean, my generation, I grew up in quiet, peaceful, liberal Denmark where nobody thought that the notion of free speech would be challenged. We took it for granted. And it was only after I traveled to the Soviet Union and spent a year there at the height of the Cold War, I experienced an oppressive dictatorship and the kind of intimidation of the public space that is going on, and how people fear. They whisper in the kitchen when they want to speak their mind, and how awful that was.
Now, I can't imagine that you were in any way prepared for the sort of outrage that
it turned out that I was more prepared than my colleagues.
But there was government. I mean, the government were called in. The prime minister was having to take charge of the situation. Embassies were under threat. Other journalists, your colleagues all over the world, in television, in print, there was a complete lack of courage shown. I remember none of the major American publications, television shows, would even explain what it was that had caused the outrage. And here we were, all of us, Googling like mad, trying to find these pictures that had caused this. They must have been the most evil possible imaginable pictures. They must have been disgusting beyond belief. And when we found them, I think most of us were kind of more horrified that people were behaving like this about cartoons.
Yeah, and I think in fact that reinforced the sense of outrage in many quarters, because I received emails from around the world from people in the United States. Where can we see the cartoons? You know, newspapers are not publishing them. And I redirected them to our website, and then came back to me and said, "Oh, is it just that?" So by not publishing the cartoons, media sent a message that this is real, real offensive. Can't even print it. And I think they are quite innocuous, those cartoons. But in doing so, they reinforced the sense of offense that, you know, this must be very, very bad. And I, you know, I don't think that publication means endorsement. You can have different opinions about those cartoons, and that's fine.
If we put a story in the newspaper about Ahmadinejad saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, does that mean that we agree with him?
Exactly.
No.
No. And it reads on the top of the New York Times all the news that fits to print. Mm. I mean, February 1st, 2006, this was news item number one in the world.
Yeah.
And it's a lack of trust in your readers to make up their mind about what you publish, that you had to decide for them.
What do you think? Do you think it was, because this is clearly a lack of courage on their part, but do you think it came from a genuine fear for their own security? Because they deep down they fear Islam and they're afraid to say that. They're not sure how to grapple with this thing. Second of all, do you think that it might have been a pressure that they felt almost that they were there to patronize their audience, that their audience should be kept away from things that might hurt them, which is almost more disturbing?
I think it was a combination of both. In fact, I spoke to one of the top editors at one of the big U.S. newspapers at the time when I, in fact, was in the U.S., and he said that they were afraid for what might happen to their correspondents around the world in the Islamic world. And I think that's a very fair argument, but be honest about it. I mean, tell the public that we do not publish those cartoons because we have to take care of our own reporters. And then people can make a judgment for themselves. And instead of telling them, you know, we know what the cartoons look like, so we don't have to, we can describe them in words and all this, frankly, sorry to say, on air bullshit that
we're
confronted with. And because if that's the way we edit a newspaper, we also know what Barack Obama looks like, so we don't have to publish photographs of him every time we ran a news story featuring him. I think the readers will think that's a little strange.
It's weak.
It's weak, yeah.
Now, on that matter, it's always struck me as interesting that people are particularly careful not to offend the religion of Islam, not to upset the followers of Islam. This is something which you consider to be egregious because you say that means you're treating Muslims differently. And in a place like Denmark, where you believe everyone is equal, it's important that everyone gets equal treatment. So when there are cartoons about Muhammad, we shouldn't get upset, just like when there are cartoons about Jesus, we shouldn't get upset, or about the Prime Minister, or about the royal family, or whoever else it might be.
Exactly.
All of these people are up for shots.
Yes, and I think that's a very fundamental point. And that's why I tell the public when I'm being asked that this was an integration project. It was a project to integrate Muslims into a Danish tradition of religious satire that has been in existence for centuries, if not decades, if not centuries, and by doing that, we were in fact saying to Muslims in Denmark, we do not expect more of you, we do not expect less of you, but we expect of you exactly the same as we do of every other individual and group in our society. And in that lies a fact of recognition, that we do not treat you as strangers, we do not treat you as children, we do not treat you as wild animals that is not able to control yourself. We treat you as our own. So you should see this as a fact of recognition that you are part of society. You are not on the periphery. You are here to stay. You are not Dutch guests that need some kind of special treatment and politeness. So I think that's the case, and in fact we had several court cases. Muslims organizations in Denmark took me and the newspaper to court, and they lost all the cases, and one of the spokespeople for the Muslim community, after having lost the court case, said, you know, I thought this was a criminal offense in Denmark, and now I have to recognize that's not the case, and then I can either leave if I don't want to live in a country like that, or I can stay and accept that this is part of reality. And I think that was a real experience for him in integration, because he really learned something about the way Danish society works, and his own place in it.
Just to stay on religion for a moment, were you disappointed at the time of the publication of these cartoons that religious leaders, including the Pope, said that they thought that while burning embassies and threatening people with violence and the most unspeakable horrors was bad, the publication of the cartoons was somehow worse, and that the Catholic Church and the Archbishop of Canterbury and innumerable other religious leaders all over the world sided with the offended Muslims?
Yeah, but I was not surprised, at least by the statements by the Pope. And I think somebody who is heading a church that was responsible for the Inquisition should be very, very careful condoning violence and justifying violence who is being justified by people who see, who believe that their faith has been attacked. But I think it's you know, this is a notion of blasphemy. We have a blasphemy law in Denmark, and it's being triggered now for the first time in 46 years.
So?
Because some stupid guy decided to burn a copy of the Quran in his backyard and post a few seconds on Facebook. Yes, it's outrageous. I do not support it, but I just don't think it should be criminalized. And in fact, by criminalizing and taking the man to court, this episode has become far more, you know, famous and seen by more people than it would have been otherwise.
It's probably just attention seeking, but the fact is that the burning of any book should be discouraged by people like us who like
reading.
Absolutely,
but I don't think it should be criminalized.
But not criminalized, yeah.
And when you criminalize speech as if it is violence, and I think this is what blasphemy laws, in fact, intend to do around the world, it undermines maybe the most crucial distinction in the history of ideas and in the fight for freedom of religion and freedom of speech and against censorship throughout history, is the separation of words and deeds. Until the Enlightenment, the Christian Church in Europe perceived blasphemous speech, heretics, criticism of religion as a physical attack on the church, on religion, on God. And therefore you had to destroy people who did that. It was being perceived as actual violence. There was no separation between, you know, evil words and evil deeds, between
and
saying
then,
something.
And then concurrently, the violence meted out against those people who were guilty of those offenses was severe.
They were burned on the stake.
Death by burning, death
they
by
had
hanging,
their
death by
tongues
cut out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's clearly no balance when you're dealing with religious fanatics.
No.
And particularly when they're ideas, because that's all they are, is a religion's a collection of ideas, when their ideas are evaluated and found lacking, that the people then guilty of evaluating those ideas must be bad, not the ideas themselves.
Yeah.
There's never any introspection.
Yes.
So when the Pope does this, you're not surprised. Tell me, are you ever apologized to for the position that was taken against you during that time? Are there newspaper editors, media personalities, religious leaders, people who come to you now and go, you know, at the time I might not have supported you, but I was wrong?
Not religious leaders, but in fact there are some politicians and editors, opinion makers who have said to me that they were wrong and I was right. I had an event in Danish Parliament some time ago, and a member of the Danish Socialist Party who had attacked me severely stood up and apologized in front of the public. And you can say in general, you know, 12 years ago, I was being demonized by a lot of people in Denmark, and I was seen as a marginal figure. 2 years ago, I received the most prestigious award by the publishing community in Denmark. So my position has become more mainstream. If you look at the public in general, in the spring of 2006, I think only 43% of the Danish public believed it was right to publish the cartoons. In 2015, almost 10 years later, it was 65%, which is a constitutional majority. So people have recognized that it was not just some kind of stunt, that the idea behind this was in fact based in a reality that we have to confront, that we have to talk about, that we have to debate. And
was it insulting to you that people thought that you were doing this as a publicity stunt?
No, I at some point I thought I had to show everybody that I'm right and they are wrong. But as time goes by and you read and you travel around the world and you see that people look at this from different angles depending on where you are, your history, environment, I have arrived at the conclusion that you can have different opinions about this. And my aim and my goal and my job is to explain my position and show how this correlates with fundamental liberal enlightenment values that I believe in. Instead of convincing other people that I'm right, I'm just trying to explain myself. And then it's up to you. If you think that my arguments are convincing, please be my guest. If not, I gave you the chance to listen and
let's
read.
Let's have a battle of ideas.
Make up your own mind.
What do you think Europe's problem is with Islam? Because there is a misunderstanding. There's some disconnect. And possibly also between Europe and their constant inability to deal with anti-Semitism, because the two almost go hand in hand. Why do you think this happens in Europe? Europe, the Enlightenment was born in Europe, but there is so much of a legacy there that we have to still deal with.
The big issue in general is Europe's lack of ability to manage diversity. And because of the Second World War and Nazism and fascism, we have been very reluctant to acknowledge that diversity is painful. It's not easy. I'm married to a Russian myself. I live in a multicultural marriage. I lived abroad, and I know that clashes of cultures, beliefs, different backgrounds is painful. But if you say that, if you used to say that in Europe, you would very easily be labeled a racist, a crazy Nazi, or a fascist. And it turns out that
is it to do with guilt?
Also, colonial good, that's not the Danish problem, but that's maybe in the UK or partly in France and the Netherlands. I think if you look at the history of Europe in the 20th century, after World War I, you had the dissolution of four empires. And instead of having multicultural empires, you started building more or less homogeneous nation states to keep the peace. So you drew new borders to have more homogeneous nation states. You still had a lot of ethnic and religious minorities living in different countries. After World War II, you also tried to build more homogeneous nation states in order to keep the peace. You had huge population swaps, especially in Eastern Europe, Ukrainians, Poles, Hungarians, Romanians, Germans coming back to Germany, and so on and so forth. And I think this indicates an unrecognized fact that Europe feels it is difficult to manage diversity, and there is this more or less conscious strive to build more homogeneous nation states. After the Second World War, you only had four states in Europe that were built and founded as multi-ethnic in their construction. Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and Belgium.
Today, all on the eastern side of the curtain.
And three of them don't exist anymore to the nationality questions and the difficulties. And Belgium is, you can say, Belgium is that a functioning state? Many people will tell you that it's not. And if you look at the terrorist attacks in Brussels, you had information in the system, but the different security apparatuses. They did not communicate because they belonged to different national communities within Belgium.
I'm going to misquote you here, I'm sure, but you said something about how many people in Europe, particularly on the left, view the Quran as just another kind of Das Kapital, where it requires accommodation, it's a philosophy, it's not particularly odious, most people don't live by it, Islam is moderate, Islam is peaceful, all of that stuff, and that this is just another book. That's not the case.
No, because, I mean, we all know that Das Kapital was being written by Karl Marx, a human being, and that means that we all have a right to challenge him and criticize him. One of the key challenges with the Quran is that Muslims see it as
the
word of God.
And unalterable.
Yes. Yeah. And therefore, it's very difficult to ask critical questions and challenge the content. People are afraid because they are afraid of being blamed for blasphemy or being heretic or apostate, and for good reasons, because blasphemers and apostates are being killed.
In most Muslim countries, even in most Western countries, apostasy, heresy, blasphemy, these are in supposedly westernized society, and I'm talking about Muslim society, in the West, these are still unacceptable things. And most people, the majority of people in those Western countries who are Muslim, believe that those three things ought to be punished with death.
Yes.
Moderate people.
Very severe sentences.
Certainly severe punishment.
But these are
Western people, for all intents and purposes.
Yes.
So do you think
many of them were born and grew up in Western Europe?
Which leads me to the question, do you think there is an incompatibility between strict Islam by the book, which is the only kind of Islam that most will tell you there is, or on the one hand, and then Western civilization, secular values, the Enlightenment, free speech on the other?
I think the jury is still out, even though, I mean, it's really an uphill battle. But, you know, last year I had the chance to talk to Steve Bannon, Trump's chief strategist in New York, and we had in fact a heated discussion about this, and Steve Bannon said to me, you know, we are at a war with Islam, and I said, I don't think so. I said, I believe we are in a hot war with violent Muslims or violent Islamists, and we are in a cold war with nonviolent Islamists. But we are not at war with Muslims in general, and we need believing Muslims on our side to fight this battle of ideas. I think it is an uphill struggle because of what I said, that the Quran is being seen as the word of God, and there is a very weak tradition of critical thinking and critical challenges of religious dogma. There is also this thing that the Quran is seen as a guide to the way you should live and practice politics.
It's the only book that you need to read, according to the mullahs.
It's the constitution, and in Christianity we have this separation of church and state, which is not in Islam, and that's a problem.
And of course, Islam hasn't been through an enlightenment.
Yeah,
like
the
Christian church was tamed by the Enlightenment.
True, but I think in fact that Islam has the best possible chance to develop an interpretation of the holy text that is compatible with the modern secular democracy in the Western world, in Europe, because they enjoy freedom of religion, they enjoy freedom of speech.
And of course, if the Quran and Islam did have all the answers, then people wouldn't be migrating to Europe.
Absolutely.
So there's some kind of overlap between where you are accommodating your beliefs and your way of life and your culture, and you're being allowed to do so in a society that is open and free, and you must in turn respect those things.
Yeah.
So you think Europe could actually be the key?
I think so, but I don't think we are doing well. I think this is where the cartoons comes in again, because It's very. We have been too reluctant to tell immigrants from the Muslim world what it means to be a European.
Mm.
That you are welcome here.
Europeans are struggling with what it means to be a European.
Yeah, yeah.
But
let me say what it means to be Danish, what it means to be Dutch,
what it means to
be French. In spite of all the national differences, we do share some common values, separation of church and state, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of movement. But of course, people prefer national identities to a common European identity. But we have not been good at telling newcomers what we expect from them.
Yeah.
What it takes to become a citizen of our society, that you have to accept equality between the sexes, that you have to accept that people can be homosexuals or LGBT without you having a right to kill them.
Mm.
That people have a right to leave their faith if they want to. That's part of freedom of religion. People have a right to be atheists or non-believers or whatever they want. You have to accept these fundamental rules, and then you are welcome. And we have not been good on that. And we have also been, allowed ghettos, big Muslim communities to be created without spreading out the population, and that means that these rules that they lived with in their lands of origin, they have been imported. And if you go into these areas in different European cities, I mean,
apparently it's a big problem in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, I heard women from Lebanon living in Sweden said that they as women felt that they had more rights in Lebanon than in this ghetto in Sweden, because you had this religious police coming up to them and say you have to cover your head to tell their kids that girls and boys are not allowed to play together.
And of course this imposition of these very strict non-secular rules on Muslims eventually extends to non-Muslims.
Yes, and that's, that was my key point during the Khartoum crisis, because people said, oh, you are disrespecting Islam by commissioning those cartoons. And I said, no. I respect Muslims, and therefore if I visit a mosque, a holy place for Muslims, I will behave in accordance with their rules. And so will my daughter if I bring her along. But when Muslims are asking me to submit myself to their dogmas outside their holy places as a non-Muslim, they are not asking for respect, they are asking for submission.
Hmm.
And that's incompatible with a liberal secular democracy. And that's why we have to challenge that.
What is it like being told that there are people who want to kill you, people you haven't met, over something that you thought was probably not as controversial as it ended being up being. How does that feel to be put on a list, a hit list, and how does it feel to have security around you all the time?
I think it's been a process. I received the first death threats in the fall of 2005, beginning of 2006, and I think back then it was a shock. And I probably experienced some kind of fear. As time, has gone by, and it's not that you get used to it, of course, but you have to reflect on what you believe in. You had to ask yourself, are there things that you're willing to stand up for, even, if it has this price, and you also have to ask, who do you want to be as a human being? What does it mean to be me? And looking in the mirror, I would just feel very, very bad about myself if I had stepped down.
But did you ever?
And apologized, because
this is the quandary. Last year, I was accused of being a racist for standing up for free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And, they fired me from a job. I had to take them to court. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of name calling, and it didn't matter how much good or fun or interesting stuff I had done before this. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, my entire reputation was this one thing, which is precisely what happened to you in a much bigger scale.
Yeah.
And there were moments where I thought, you know what, if I just apologize and I accept a guilt that I don't have, and I'm willing to shut up and disappear quietly, it might be better for my health. Did you feel that way?
Never. But also because I looked at Salman Rushdie, who at one point, in fact, apologized, and he even converted to Islam.
Hmm.
And he later said, it's the most stupid thing I ever did, and I regret it deeply. Because it will not change anything. Do you think I will get off Al-Qaeda's hit list if I apologize? No. Then you will just be met with new demands, and if you cave into intimidation and threats, you will not get less of it. You will get more of it because you tell people who intimidate and threaten that it works. So why stop?
Yeah, and they extort you until you've got nothing left.
Yeah, and I will also say, you know, as with time, I have come to recognize, you know, that I have been provided a platform, and I mean, in Denmark, this debate and these issues do have a lot of symbolic value.
Mm.
So if I apologize, if I say I didn't mean it, it will have very wide-ranging consequences, not only for me but for the general climate in Denmark, I would say, and maybe in other parts of Europe. So I also feel now a certain responsibility for, you know, the position I have and the platform I'm speaking on. Apart from all the principal matters that I believe in, but. You know, today I'm not afraid, and maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but I have thought about what will I do the day I am facing a violent Islamist. Will I run away? Will I confront him? Will I try to take him down? I hope the last. I hope that if they're coming after me, I will be able to take out as many as possible, or my bodyguards will, or whatever.
Are there places you cannot go?
Yeah.
Like where?
Well, I will not go on a beach vacation to Saudi Arabia, for instance. But I can live without that. But, you know, I move around with bodyguards in Europe, which means that I will have protection wherever I go.
But you spend most of your time in America now, do you?
No, I commute. In fact, I still live in Denmark, but I travel quite a lot.
And were you ever worried for your family? Because,
of course.
You know, the problem
and I was
is
also worried for my colleagues and my workplace.
And you did mention the Charlie Hebdo guys who you knew.
Yeah.
And who were obviously killed for similar reasons that you might have been killed. Did you feel when that was happening that this was, it was almost as if you were living a nightmare because this was the alternate reality for you?
Yeah. And I mean, some of these people were my friends. And, you know, Charlie Hebdo's love affair, in quotation mark, with the Prophet Muhammad and Islam started with our cartoons. Because Charlie Hebdo in February 2006 republished all our cartoons after a French newspaper editor was being fired for having published them. And I appeared as a witness in a court case in Paris against Charlie Hebdo, where they were being taken to court for publishing our cartoons and some of their own, and they were acquitted. So I had a close relationship with some of them, and I mean that day, February 7, 2015, it's the worst day of my life. It's the worst day at work in my life.
Almost 10 years after your situation.
Yeah. And, you know, it didn't come as a surprise because anybody who had been following what was going on in Europe since 2005 wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there were fire bombings, there were threats, there were plots aborted. But nevertheless, when it happens, you are just devastated and in a state of shock. And I also think that we owe those people who sacrificed their lives for free speech and the right to ridicule and mock religion that we do not give in, because in that case, their sacrifices would be in vain.
And then next they come for you for something much less
exactly.
obvious. Yeah. You've written a couple of books. One of your books, American Voices, you went around America asking some significant and important public intellectuals their point of view about the cartoons and about free speech and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And you also published a book about Tavshidin's Tyranny.
The Tyranny of Silence.
The Tyranny of Silence.
It's in fact in English, How One Cartoon Ignited a Global Debate on the Future of Free Speech.
Now, apparently when you published that book, the Danish foreign minister actually had to sit down with ambassadors for 17 different countries to reassure them that this was not going to be a reprint of the Muhammad cartoons.
Mm-hmm. But they were reprinted in the book, in fact. and there were people who, in fact, accused me of inciting a new cartoon crisis, and they wanted me to withdraw the book.
People in government?
No, not in government, fortunately, but some ordinary Danes. But the book was published. All the cartoons were there, but there were also other cartoons, other offensive depictions throughout history. I wrote a section about offensive images. I started the history of offensive images, and I found out, there is no such thing as an offensive image in and by itself. It's always in the eye of the beholder. And the sense of offense changes throughout history and across cultures and countries. And if you take Edouard Manet, he did a wonderful impressionistic painting called Lunch on the Green Grass, where you have a naked woman sitting in the woods with two men. And when that's painted today, when you see that painting in Paris, you see it as a harmonious image, and you cannot believe that this at some point was perceived as offensive. But when this painting first was exhibited in France in 1865, viewers tried to destroy it, to jump and tear it apart, because it was being seen as very provocative and offensive that you have a naked woman staring at the painter without being shy. So the sense of offense does not exist in and by itself. It's always in the eye of the beholder, and it changes with time and history and culture and country.
I'm interested in what you said earlier about how we mustn't allow speech to be considered violence.
Yeah.
And other forms of expression which are non-violent to be co-opted into violence, because that's when we lose our ability to have free thought and to promulgate free thought and to stand up for free thought, and where thought becomes a crime. Can you expand on this for me? Because I think it's something that a lot of people are very rudimentary about these things.
Yes.
It's either black or white. It's not entirely clear to them.
Yeah.
Words cannot be violence on their own, no matter how awful they are.
Exactly. I mean, words can incite violence, but for me to criminalize that kind of speech, there need to be a clear and present danger that words will be followed by action. Like in the Rwandan genocide, you go on radio and you say, go on, kill all the Tutsis or the Hutus or whatever. I think that should be a criminal offense. That incitement to violence should not be allowed. But apart from that, I think more or less that people should have the right to speak their mind, even when they say very offensive things. It's about cultivating a climate where you work out your disagreements with words, even though it may feel very offensive and insulting and points. You do not recourse to violence. You do not call on the courts to come in and criminalize speech. And I think the key notion here is a better understanding of what the concept of tolerance means. Today, many people, or most people, in fact, believe that there is an inherent tension between free speech and tolerance, and that you somehow have to balance these two concepts. The fact of the matter is that tolerance and freedom are two sides of the same coin, that you cannot have real freedom of speech without being allowed to say things that other people feel is offensive. And that is, you know, tolerance. And you cannot have real tolerance without people be allowed to say things that you really dislike. What does tolerance mean? Tolerance, in fact, means the ability to live with things that you hate, to be exposed to speech that you really dislike and hate without using violence, threats, and intimidation to silence it or to ban it. That is, in fact, the concept of tolerance. And if we understand that, we also understand that that free speech and tolerance, in fact, are very closely connected. And if you look at it in a historical perspective, the concept of tolerance began with religious tolerance after the wars of religion in Europe in the 16th century. Protestant and Catholics in Europe killed one another in tens of thousands for decades. And finally, they understood this is not a good way to go about it. Let's work out a concept of tolerance. And it meant that Catholics stopped killing Protestants because they were of a different faith. And it meant that they could live within the same borders, but not in the same towns in the beginning. Mm. But they stopped killing one another. And then with time, they started living in the same town, but in different quarters. And today, Protestant and Catholics, they live in the same
household.
Building. Exactly.
Marriages.
And they don't have any issues with one another. So we have to reconquer the concept of tolerance instead of thinking the tolerance is about, turning the other cheek, keeping silent about things that you don't like,
and worse,
don't say offensive things.
And worse, being patronizing by treating
yes.
other people as being special and requiring
yes.
special sensitivities
yeah.
as if they were in some way intellectually incapable
yeah.
of understanding.
Yes.
Which is,
it's also very important to say that tolerance does not mean that you keep silent.
Mm.
In fact, tolerance implies that you speak out against the things that you don't like.
Mm.
But you do not use violence, you do not threaten, you do not intimidate, and you do not try to ban. That is what tolerance is about. So in a way, tolerance is the most incredible concept worked out by mankind to manage disagreements and to manage diversity. And I think, contrary to the strive for freedom, which is a natural human instinct, we all want to be free. We don't want other people to interfere with our freedom. We want to decide for ourselves. I think everybody has that instinct somewhere.
Mm.
But tolerance is in many ways diametral to our human instincts, because we want to shut down things that we don't like. When we get something in our mouth that doesn't taste well, we spit it out. We don't want to be in a room with people that we don't like. We don't want to talk to them. We don't want to live next to them. So tolerance is a very vulnerable and fragile thing that we have to cultivate. And unfortunately, in many quarters in the liberal West, we have lost an understanding of what tolerance means. So during the Khartoum crisis, I was being accused of being intolerant, while in fact, the real intolerant people were those who tried to ban the cartoons or threatened me and threatened the newspaper.
But what role does political correctness play in all of this?
It plays a huge role.
Because you've
it's a way of leveling and not being honest about what you believe and think. And it's very widespread in the United States, where you have, in fact, the best protection of speech in the world in the law. But the social pressures on speech in the United States is far stronger than in Europe.
Particularly, it seems, at academic institutions. Somehow, yeah, academia.
I experienced that myself because I spent time in the U.S.
Yeah. Why is it? Why do you think that happens? And even in this country, we have a situation now where political correctness in academia is starting to poison the well of good intellectual argument. You don't have people engaging in proper intellectual argument for fear of being politically incorrect and for fear thereof of being, you know, thrown out.
And what are they afraid of?
Disbarred. In this country, you were invited to speak at UCT and in the most abject and pathetic and weak sign of failure, they withdrew their invitation to have you speak.
Yeah, but they in fact the people who invited me did not withdraw it, and I think it's important to stress that the Academic Freedom Committee at UCT insisted on going on with the event, and but the Vice Chancellor Max Price intervened and decided to withdraw without having read my book, that at that point had been out in English for almost 2 years. Instead, he decided to quote people who attacked me in a very dishonest way by misquoting me.
This is intentional, willful ignorance.
I mean, it's an academic institution. I mean, they were brought up to read and think for themselves. And you have a book to find out where I stand.
I would like to
didn't bother to read it.
As a South African, I'd like to apologize for Max Price.
You don't have to. I mean, it's his.
I'm embarrassed by him. That's all. I'm glad you're here eventually at the invitation of the Institute of Race Relations, and those people who wanted to hear you in Cape Town can hear you anyway. It doesn't matter. Thank God for the internet. But I apologize for people like Max Price. They make life very, very complicated and difficult for those of us who actually do believe in something like civilization, who do believe in intellectual honesty, who do have some inkling of what our own integrity might look like.
Yeah, and it undermines, in fact, academic freedom. It undermines knowledge production. If you have taboos, if there are things that you would not challenge, if there are questions that you don't want to ask, if you don't want to have unfettered inquiry, you undermine knowledge production. And knowledge production is what makes a society as a whole competitive. It is what makes us grow as human beings, to master our own lives and to become masters of our own destiny. If you are being treated as immature children who are not able to think for yourself and make decisions for yourself, if grown up have to make decisions on behalf of grown up, what kind of speech they should be listening to and what kind of speech they should not listen to, it really undermines everything. And if you take the U.S., I think it's a combination of many things. You have this ideology of postmodernism entering the academia a while ago, where everything is being phrased in notions of power and privilege. I recently spoke at a university in Pennsylvania, and I was met with a poster saying, "Check your white privilege at the door." I did not grow up in the U.S. English is not my native language. So they were indicating that, you know, if they are Muslims and I'm not non-Muslim, if I'm white and they are black, we cannot have a conversation because I am white. I'm privileged by definition.
Is this not racism?
It is.
Of the most obvious kind.
Of course.
This kind of let's group everyone together.
Identity politics.
And therefore there is no individuality. And
yes,
therefore we can start to make stereotypical ideas up about this group of people, and they will have to just accept them.
Absolutely.
And we'll develop a victim hierarchy, and whoever is at the top of that victim hierarchy is the one who will get to say things, and the people at the bottom will be told to be subjects.
Yes.
This is racism. This is the worst kind of elitism. it's precisely the opposite of what it's intended to achieve.
Absolutely. And I try to explain to these young people that identity politics put people into boxes and try to fence them in. You don't have only one identity. I mean, yes, I'm white, I'm male, but I'm also a grandfather, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm an older brother, I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, I'm a soccer fan, I'm all kinds of things. And I don't want to be boxed in into one identity. I want to be able to, put on different identities in different situations. But if you put people in and reduce them to one identity, you really take away their humanity.
And personality and all the things
yes,
that we love about.
And I said to him, I think we should focus more on what we share as human beings. You may be black and I may be white, but we have the same genes. I mean, what it means to be human is not different when it comes to the basic things. Yes, we had to have different experiences, but I am able to put myself in the shoes of another person. You have writers, you have male writers about writing about what it means to be a female. You have white writers writing about what it means to be black, and black writers writing about what it means to be white. And that is possible because we are human beings.
Now, was Shakespeare
and we have
not
the ability
meant to
hit.
Was Shakespeare not meant to make Othello such a sympathetic character?
Exactly.
You know, it just boggles the mind the way these people. But I want to get back to you for a second because we've been talking and I could talk to you all day. And not just because I agree with you, by the way. I'm sure there are lots of things we would disagree on. You had an interesting reconciliation with your father. You didn't really grow up with him very much in your life, but these cartoons suddenly brought him back into it.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us that story?
Yeah. I think it was maybe a year or two after the publication of the cartoons, I received a letter from my father who I hadn't heard from for decades. And he suggested that maybe we should meet, and we met in Copenhagen, and I had the opportunity to ask him, some questions. He left my mother with three small kids. I think I was 4 years old. My younger brothers were 2 and 1, so it was a very difficult situation. And he found a younger woman and moved in with her. But I think I got a better understanding. I had been very angry at him, I would say, and I felt disappointed, that he had abandoned his family. But talking to him, I understood that he had had a very difficult life himself, that his mother had been killed in a traffic accident when he was just 13. That his father didn't bother much, and in fact he was being brought up by his grandfather. And he, I think, materially, he had a difficult life. So I think we had peace. At least I had a peace of mind, and I understand that life is difficult, and even though I maybe, I thought that maybe he should have behaved differently, there was an explanation for his choices in life, and it also made me understand myself, in fact, a little better, because growing up without him, and seeing that he also had grown up without his parents. I have been struggling as a parent myself because I didn't have any role models what it meant to be a parent or be a father. For some time I think I pay too less attention to my kids. I have a Russian wife who is very family
oriented.
And she really taught me, about the values of obligations and the importance of being present as a parent. I'm very happy that I had the chance to to talk to my father before he passed away. He passed away a couple of years ago.
I commend you on the work that you're doing, particularly with regard to free speech, and the Cato Institute must be fascinating. I'd love to know more about that, but we'll have to save it for another time. Fleming Rose, thank you so much for coming to speak to us, and carry on the good fight, please.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.